really like to spend. Yes, this event is recorded. I'd really like to thank everyone for coming. We had a lot of response. I think there was over 100 registrations. But I want to particularly for now thank Slice Mango, Alisa, SFU, Van City's Office for Office of Community Engagement, UBC Asian Canadian Asian Migration Studies, and UBC Public Humanities for helping us put together this talk. My name is Bill Yuen, and I'm the Executive Director of Heritage Vancouver Society. And we were quite interested in this topic, and we've been doing some events about the Food Hub. And this is our third event. Tonight's event is a follow-up event to something we called Listening Room in December of last year. And at that event, we listened to community stories about the Food Hub and neighborhood. The Food Hub is located on two sites that are up for condo development. And we listened to Claire from Slice Mango. She was one of the people who conducted their own community outreach separate from the City of Vancouver engagement about the proposed development on those two sites. We also listened to Bennett, the owner of Plateau Filipino, one of the businesses on the site. I believe she couldn't make it tonight, but yeah, I think she wished us well. So that event that we had in December looked at the Food Hub from one perspective. And it happened that many in attendance were very connected and supportive of the Food Hub. Tonight's event is to bring community stories and perspectives into the context of planning. And so in this bigger world around city decisions, how to use land, complicated and difficult for places like the Food Hub. I do want to be clear and emphasize that our guests tonight are not here as sides representing the Food Hub versus property development. In particular, Meg and Neil are here because they study and think deeply and critically about planning and development and are able to help us understand planning better and raise questions. They are not necessarily here as representatives of transit-oriented development. We will be having Q&A at the end, and I trust that everyone will be respectful to all our guests. I'm not sure what the makeup of the audience is tonight, but I think whether or not you are personally connected to the Joyce Collingwood neighborhood or not, I think this topic is important for everybody if you have a place in Vancouver that is important for you, especially along big streets where the street functions more like a commons. A lot of streets are up for development. For example, you know, Main Street, Kingsway, Fraser between 41st and 49th, Broadway between McDonald and Alma. And these are, you know, streets that I think a lot of people are connected to, like people tonight, you know, who are connected to the Food Hub. So I think this is relevant in a bigger way to a lot of us. We are holding this event on the traditional and ancestral lands that we're taking away from the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh. We are also having a discussion tonight on a place important to people who are and have been underrepresented. For several years now, it has been very important for my organization to change how we practice heritage and to change how the public understands heritage. One of those changes is the importance of listening to, understanding, and making space for the stories of all communities, how people make meaning, whether they have a strong connection to a building or a custom or a way of life. This is because we come from a tradition where we are the experts and in general have not had to go out and listen to others. At our previous event, our guest Bennett said to me that when I visit her restaurant, the food might not suit my palate. I may not like it. I think this is an important important point about what we are discussing tonight about planning and differences in neighborhoods and how the Joy Strip with the food hub is thought of. If you're just humoring me for a second, there's a popular story about a famous food critic in Los Angeles, Jonathan Gould. He's well known for writing serious stories about restaurants in the Los Angeles Times about, and usually writes about restaurants that are not considered mainstream or fancy. So restaurants in strip malls or a hole in the walls with two people running them, usually immigrants. There's a famous story around him about a restaurant that he didn't, where he didn't like the food. So he went to this Taiwanese restaurant. He really didn't like the food. And this story is famous because he went back to the restaurant 17 times. And when he's asked why he went back to the restaurant 17 times, he explained that because he realizes that he's in a position of power to describe this restaurant, even though he didn't like the food, he saw that people around him liked the food. He saw that the people around him enjoyed themselves. And he needed to understand why they felt that way in order for him to write the review. So I think when Bennett said to me that her food wouldn't suit my palate, I think the response is that it doesn't matter if I like it. So I'd like to start by having our guests introduce themselves and talk about how they're connected to the neighborhood. Hannah, can we start with you? And maybe you could talk about, you know, your work and how you're connected to this neighborhood.
You said Hannah, right?
Yes.
I'm just hearing a bit of feedback. Okay, can everybody hear me? Good. Okay, so hi everybody. My name is Hannah Balba and I'm a settlement worker at Collingwood Neighborhood House. And a little bit about my work as a settlement worker. I'm mostly responsible for helping newcomers connect to the various resources that they need, whether that be applying for government subsidies, housing, health, education, finance. We have a very, you know, holistic approach when it comes to connecting newcomers with the resources that they need to meet the unique challenges that they face, you know, adjusting to their life here. And so I've been connected actually with Collingwood since my college days when I first started working as an academic and social support mentor for newly arrived Filipino youth for the UBC Kababayan Academic Mentorship Program. And I worked as a mentor in various Vancouver high schools that have a higher population of newly arrived Filipino youth. A program saw the need for, you know, mentorships between older Filipino post-secondary students and Filipino youth in high school in order to promote post-secondary education and academic pursuit as Filipino youth face very unique challenges, especially in regards to education. You know, for a while, Filipino youth have faced higher dropout rates in comparison to other, you know, visible minority groups. And so that's what our program was set out to address. And I think a lot of our referrals at camp were from actually Collingwood Neighborhood House. So we had many of our meetings there. You know, I was frequently there for some time in UBC. And then, you know, that work with camp also led me to work with the West Coast Domestic Workers Association, which is now called the Migrant Worker Center, as I did notice that many of the Filipino youth that I was working with are children of former domestic workers. And so I did some, and the Migrant Worker Center is a pro bono legal clinic providing access to justice for migrant workers in Vancouver. And so, I did some organizing with caregivers at the legal clinic. Many of them also lived in the Joyce Collingwood area. And if they didn't live there, they frequented that area. And so I made sure some of the events and some of the organizing took place there as well in order to boost member engagement with the legal clinic. And so, you know, I think this work, there were a lot of very radicalizing moments for me in this kind of work. And so I think it really led and guided my academic background or my academic pursuits in that much of my research in university related to the history of domestic work in Canada and in relation to Filipino labor migration and the impacts of these programs on the people themselves, on caregivers themselves and their children. I was also a former student of Dr. J.P. Katungal's and his work on women of color, feminist theory, and, you know, looking at the representations of Filipino domestic workers in political public discourse in the diaspora has been very important and has been a guiding work for me. And so after graduating, I wanted to be more involved with the community. And since I've been sort of connected here for 5+ years or so now, it wasn't hard to hear about the need for more settlement workers at CNH, which brings me here to this work now. And, you know, I've been able to make sense of my own experiences as a migrant woman in relation to other Filipinos and to understand better the responsibilities that come with identifying as Filipino or claiming, you know, this ethnic membership with a community. And Joyce Collingwood has always been a place that helped bring these moments of clarity for me.
Thank you, Hannah. Neil, would you like to go next? I know that you really like food culture and we talked about that in relation to the food hub. And you also taught your class, you used this example in your class, so.
Yeah, a few times. Thank you, Bill. Hopefully I sound okay. Wonderful to be part of this amazing group of people on such a important and interesting issue. My name is Neil LaMontagne. I'm a city planner, faculty lecturer at the University of Alberta in the planning school there. And yeah, I think I was attracted to city planning, not only because cities are infinitely interesting, but they're such rich experiential places. And part of that experience of what draws us to the city are things like the amazing diversity of things to eat. And I see in the attendee list, a friend of mine, Fernando Medrano, who uses that term gastro-urbanist, which I've always loved and has sort of adopted as a bit of an identity myself. I'll label myself as experiencing the city, to use my other friend Andy Ann's line, one bite at a time. And that's sort of part of my history with Joyce Collingwood, because I always went to Collingwood, like wonderful stretch of Kingsway to the area around Joyce Station, because it's just a great place to go get something tasty to eat on the way to other fantastic parts of the region with tasty things to eat. So we've looked at this in my classes. I have some experience doing planning in the area, just slightly further west in the Norquay area. So the challenge of planning in East Van is something I certainly appreciate. So really happy to be part of this conversation. I'm gonna pass it off to the next.
How about Will?
And the question is, what brings me to this work?
Tell us about your planning background and how you got involved in the community work around the food hub.
Sure. There's a long answer and a short answer. The short answer is one day a Filipino community member connived me into doing event planning, and that was about 5 years ago. And I started working my way through the Filipino organizations, doing event planning. And as someone who sits on the board of directors for several organizations who do Filipino work, we were made aware of these potential businesses that were going to be displaced. I got into this work specifically for my supervisor, Dr. Nora Angeles, She got me into my planning degree. Well, she didn't get me into a planning degree, but she spurred my interest in planning, and she unveiled the cover over my eyes about how my work in the Filipino community is relevant to planning and this whole new world of planning. The long answer about my planning degree is I was doing arts and culture work off the side of my desk on two different jobs. And Nora helped me see that this planning work I could transition into a career that would help our community, is relevant to my civic interests. I stayed ever since. I do work now with the Joy Street Action Network, which is an organization trying to protect the businesses along Joy Street. We were pushing through a motion that helped begin the research for intangible cultural assets, and it's moving along, it's progressing. I'm hoping to see more, and hopefully we can discuss that further in this panel. But yeah, short answer is I got connived into the work.
Well, Meg, can you go next?
Sure, Bill, thank you. Yeah, I'm also really happy to be part of this conversation and to learn more about the great organizing that's going on in Joyce Collingwood. My name's Meg Holden. A couple of reasons why I'm here, I think. One of them I want to start with is the very personal reason that I live near the headwaters of Still Creek, and the creek that used to flood all along Kingsway, which you can tell today because of all the amazing fruit trees and other plants that seem to just pop out of the earth as if unassisted these days in Joyce Collingwood neighborhood. My children go to Windermere Secondary and are becoming more connected to the neighborhood day by day, one bubble tea at a time. So we're constantly walking around in Joyce Collingwood neighborhood. And I'm also a professor of urban studies based at the downtown campus of SFU in Vancouver. Certainly, we have no shortage of Filipino urbanist students. In fact, you made me, speaking of being connived into doing things, you made me remember that one of my former students, Filipina students, connived me into baptizing my child and is my child's godmother, which I probably wouldn't have done if it hadn't been for her good Catholic presence and reminders. The professional, the academic reason that I wanted to bring to this conversation is about neighborhoods. So I'm an urban researcher of neighborhoods, particularly neighborhoods that call themselves sustainable and model neighborhoods. And I would like to bring to this discussion both some work that some of my students and I have been doing just south of Joyce Collingwood in the South Vancouver neighborhoods related to some threats and inequities going on there. And then also just to sort of reflect a bit on what I think is a, I don't know how hidden it is anymore, but certainly a counter narrative to the story about how neighborhood planning works in Vancouver, and to talk about the social dimensions of infrastructure and the social dimensions of neighborhood planning that are not being addressed as planning is currently practiced.
Thanks, Meg. And JP, it's your turn. You have a lot of different hats as well. So if you can just briefly tell us about that.
I do. Thank you very much for having me and for inviting me to be part of this wonderful panel. I'm really looking forward to the conversations. I do bring quite a lot of different and intersecting hats to the conversation, academic, personal, and community. They, to me, are not very easy to disentangle. So I'll go through them in those categories just as a heuristic. But in my mind and in my practice, hopefully I give you the sense that they really are really entangled with each other. I'm a faculty member at UBC in the Institute for Gender, Race, Sexuality, and Social Justice in the Asian Canadian and Asian Migration Studies program. These are interdisciplinary fields, but my academic background is actually pretty disciplinary and traditional. So all of my degrees are in geography. I'm an urban geographer by training with the focus of my research having been and continues to be on community organizing by migrant, racialized, and LGBTQ communities, particularly to address the ways that they are abandoned by mainstream approaches to social services, education, and health provision. I've also done research, particularly in the Toronto context, where I did my graduate training on neighborhood planning, and particularly neighborhood planning done under the rubric of the creative city, highly controversial, well-debated approach to planning. And the particular effects that has had on street level securitization and beautification with spillover effects for poor and sex worker communities in the city. So that's some of the academic perspectives that I do bring to this conversation, which are informed by my personal and community ties. I'm a first generation immigrant from the Philippines. My family came to Canada when I was 13 years old. Like a lot of migrant Filipino families, my family is working class, resulting partly from the fact of de-skilling. That is an effect of Canada's migration policy. My parents experiences in education were not recognized, and so they continue to not be able to practice the kinds of work and experience and training that they had in the Philippines, and have been kind of shepherded into service class positions. So that is my family background. The first place that we lived in when we moved to Canada was just right by Joyce Collingwood on the Burnaby side. We were literally on Boundary Road. And so Joyce Collingwood was a really important landing space for us when we first moved to Canada. We went to church at St. Mary's and we frequented the businesses, the Filipino businesses that are in that neighborhood, not only for practical reasons, but also for the sense of community and home and connection that they enabled for us. So part of why it's important for me to bring up my own kind of personal positionalities is because, like I said, this is the personal is academic for me. It's political to me, and they really inform the ways that I approach what it means for me to be an academic. And so community work is a key philosophy and principle of my own academic practice, and that involves working with community organizations, particularly ones that serve marginalized communities. I work with the Hua Foundation these days on the Language Access Project, which is an offshoot of the C19 Response Coalition that brought together Vietnamese, Tagalog, and Chinese-speaking community groups to provide support related to COVID-19 in ways that are culturally appropriate and linguistically accessible. So I've also worked with Filipino community organizations. Hannah mentioned one of them, the Babayan Academic Mentorship Program, is a community partner of mine in one research project that I'm involved in. I feel like I've said too much, so I'll volley it over back to Bill.
Thank you. So I'd like to start by talking about the neighborhood a little bit before we kind of get into talking about planning and transit-oriented development. This area has a plan called the Joyce Collingwood precinct plan. And when I look at that plan, it doesn't really tell me very much about the communities in the neighborhood and how people depend on places in the neighborhood. So I'd like to start with that, right? So maybe particularly Hannah, JP, and Will, William, can you talk about how people depend on this area, the food hub? For example, Hannah, you know, newcomers, what do they need? And
yeah, I can try my way at that question. Thank you, Bill. So, you know, I would say that knowing the kinds of supports newcomers need really depends on several factors, right? It ranges from their immigration status, the nature of the immigration programs that they've arrived through, you know, their age, their employment status, gender, you know, among many other intersecting positionalities, right? So for instance, you know, many of the seniors, Joyce Collingwood has a high population of seniors who live there and who have lived there for decades. And but now, because of the rising cost of rent and because of these, you know, increased number of projects that are being developed in the area that is not so much promoting affordable housing, many of the seniors I assist need more support, you know, accessing subsidized housing, right? And our way of intervening, you know, I'm speaking in perspective of, as a settlement worker, okay? And so our way of intervening is by, for one, referring them to the seniors department at CNH, who can assist in applying for subsidized housing and things like SAFER, which is a rental subsidy available for eligible seniors. You know, however, many seniors still come to see us at settlement because they understandably are more comfortable working with providers who can speak their language, right? And so with that, I believe that more funding towards translation services can really help, you know, relieve some of the responsibilities and some of the duties as a settlement worker to help these seniors, you know, understand the forms and understand especially the activities that are happening in the neighborhood, right? I believe that having more robust interpretation services or interpretation staff in, you know, communicating the activities that are happening in the Joyce Collingwood neighborhood is really important so that seniors know what's happening and know what's at stake for them, right? You know, there's also, I serve a lot of Filipina caregivers and domestic workers as well, and mental health supports, you know, higher wages and affordable childcare are primary concerns for many of these care workers who are often mothers with young, working mothers with young children, right? And so we have different self-esteem workshops and women's leadership and development workshops that are developed and facilitated by some of the other settlement workers in my department that can help them gain some confidence and help them gain self-esteem and to find community with other newcomer women. And so, you know, for newcomer youth, mentorship supports, right, whether academic, community, or professional, I believe are measures that can, you know, in my previous work as a camp mentor, you know, these are measures that can really promote harm reduction among youth, especially with the kinds of unique challenges that Filipino youth face with substance abuse, you know, higher educational dropout rates, and gang violence. And I say that, but I also, it's important to think, you know, to when we talk about these communities, not to think of them as at risk or at risk of vulnerability or at risk of these issues. Like JP articulated previously, their life trajectories are direct consequences of immigration programs like the Live-in Caregiver Program, the Temporary Foreign Worker Program. And so these programs have historically promoted things like family separation and generally keeping immigrants in precarity. So those are some of the supports that I believe that I advocate for, that I believe that newcomers need. But these supports also, they intersect, but at the same time, they're also really dependent on, you know, where a person is on the social map, right? Those are just some of the supports that I, as a settlement worker, can offer to, you know, meet some of their needs.
So JP and Will, you do some work and you're involved with other groups. And I think Hannah too. Do the people that you work with, aside from the neighborhood house, which is hugely important, what are people's relationships to places like the Food Hub or St. Mary's or you know, how do they kind of claim that space that so that it serves them and it's useful for them?
Okay, I'll go ahead, Clea. So you heard from Hannah the great services that Collingwood Neighborhood House provides. That is a flag for the Filipino community that this is a safe space and a place where we can be in community together. You mentioned St. Mary's, the Filipino businesses. Those are also flags that signals to our community that these are safe spaces for us to be in community with each other. We did a town hall a few weeks ago that asked what the Filipino community considers as a cultural asset, and it's safety, belonging, and a hearing your own language. This is an aspect of that. Those are major indicators that Filipino community members could be together in the same space and enjoy each other's presence. It just signals to me in those values that these are spaces and places where we will continue to congregate, but that's already been made happen. That's the flag has been planted in these spaces. And if we completely eradicate these communities, all of that's going to be lost. If the food businesses leave and St. Mary's loses all of their membership because they came for the food assets, that flag is now gone and we have to replant it somewhere else with the different spaces that we now have to claim as ours. So the connections to the Food Hub and Joyce Collingwood in relation to seniors, care workers, and newly arrived youth, that's been made possible through all of these assets, through Collingwood Neighborhood House, the Food Hub. Does that make sense? I'm trying to articulate here that For all the reasons that Hannah laid out, where the programs are happening in this space, these are important to our community, and we have established what that importance is, and that's safety and belonging. And that safety and belonging comes from language. That safety and belonging comes from being able to have access to your food. That safety and belonging happens by seeing another community member out in the street.
JP, do you have anything
to add? I do. I'm going to flip the coin and talk about the other side of what William mentioned. Our community, and by our community, William and I are talking about both next communities by and large, but I want to say that, you know, we don't just need our community, it's not just our community that needs this space. The vibrancy and the sense of place and the accessibility, what makes Joyce Collingwood great is the result of histories of work that our community has done as builders of this city, right? So we are not begging for our needs to be recognized, for our needs to be met. We are asking that our contributions to the sense of place in this city also be part of how we narrate the city, right? So I want to put that out there in part because we need to talk about what makes a city a city. And often marginalized communities and the ground level work that the labor, the literal labor of placemaking that, you know, has been something that our community has involved, has been involved in this community in Joyce Collingwood for a long time, right, is often not part of that narrative. So along with being a food hub, along with being, you know, an accessible transit hub, it is a community infrastructure. Like there's a set of community infrastructures there that are there at least partly because of the people that are there who frequent it, who has shaped it based on their desires and their needs. That includes the neighborhood house, the entrepreneurs and business owners, St. Mary's, and the programs that they have there, right? So that is also, I think, a connection that we should recognize in terms of, you know, seniors, care workers, newly arrived youth. They are not just consumers of that space. They are that, but they're also key shapers of that space, and they have been for a while.
So I want to turn to Neil and Meg, and I think this is a two-part question, but you've heard what was just said, and I think first I want to kind of turn to the question of, can you explain what transit-oriented development is? And then I'll get to my second part.
I guess I'll jump in and Meg can fill in the gaps. Transit-oriented development is, we always try to shorten to that acronym of TOD. So I'll use TOD from now on. You know, at its most basic, the idea is where you have good transit access, that should be the focus of a good amount of our planning and orienting of new development. So not only are we looking to locate our highest intensity uses around transit stations, higher residential densities, you know, more commercial options, community services, assets, and hubs and gathering places where the access is greatest because of the transit, but also orienting them to make transit really easy to use. So it's all about supporting transit, allowing transit to support these new communities. And it really responds to a couple pushes. One, you have this big investment in transit. You want to make sure you take advantage of it, but also that you have a lot of demand to be near that transit, particularly in the Lower Mainland Metro Vancouver region. That itself, and it's a problematic term. I think it's come under a lot of critique, very fair critique. I share that critique of just the initials themselves of transit-oriented development. And we've seen a big push towards transit-oriented communities or other phrases that try to capture the greater nuance of what you're trying to accomplish. But that TOD has become such a broadly embraced idea because at its core, it makes a lot of sense. You want to coordinate your land use planning, your city planning, and your transportation planning. You want to make sure that transit works. And transit can do a lot of the heavy lifting, so to speak, of how we move people around the region. So from a sort of a basic boiled down perspective, that's kind of TOD. It's part of a whole cluster of ideas that really emerged, I think, in the 80s and 90s as a big pushback against what was seen as too much emphasis on new development, always on the suburban edge, and generally always too auto-oriented. I've probably missed a ton.
Yeah. So I don't disagree with Neil at all. I think that's right. And I would put that, Bill, in the context of this whole big push towards smart growth, new urbanism, sustainable communities, a green city. And it you know, the point about making the most of a big investment in a piece of infrastructure around which a community can grow in a different way, in a less resource extractive way, in a potentially in a more socially connected way too, than has been the traditional white colonial Canadian model of community development. But I'm going to just jump right into the critique, because JP has already introduced it, I think, quite effectively, that why does this work and why is this introduced? It's introduced based upon a blank slate mentality, right? And that's the big problem with it. It's when you try and introduce a partial physical infrastructure based solution to a community that already has a huge amount of social infrastructure and quite a bit of existing layers of both tangible and intangible kinds of relationships and organizations, ways of behaving, ways of getting by, ways of making, you know, making their lives meaningful and sticking together. And so there's the very dark side of this story that we can talk about, which has to do with, you know, the intentional effort to break apart communities, whether they're Indigenous communities, whether they're immigrant communities, and I'm not gonna sweep that under the rug. That's real. There's also the other sort of let's all get along kind of mentality, which I think is maybe even worth more consideration in a kind of discussion forum like this, because there's a way in which transit-oriented development sort of says, okay, well, you know, we're all going to have our multicultural communities, but at least we can agree that we need some good transportation solutions. And at least we can agree that this is a good thing to spend money on. And at least we can agree that we're going to create this sort of basis for a rising tide to float all boats. And there will be more people and more money circulating. And so we should all agree that this is going to benefit everybody ultimately down the road. And so I think that, so those are both real. And I think that for as far as the city of Vancouver now, I think the second concern is more the live one that groups organizing within Joyce Collingwood can actually try to call to account by raising the need for social infrastructure planning, by raising the need for attention to language, attention to all of these things that now the city of Vancouver does pay lip service to and have real plans and policies to address, including equity within neighborhood planning, attention to equity deserving and marginalized groups, and attention to the needs of diverse communities. And then just one thing I'll say before I pass the mic is that at the end of this road, right? So, I mean, like the end of this road where I think everybody can see now that we're heading, because we've seen it happen in more westerly Vancouver neighborhoods and in the downtown core, is a whitewashed community in which then the city is going to be faced with this need to sort of put incentives in place in order to bring the Filipino community back into a neighborhood that it was pushed out of, as we've seen happen in cities just to the south of us, like Seattle, where, you know, where transit-oriented development and the gentrification processes that ensued made it impossible for the existing Black businesses to stay and Black communities to stay. And now that, you know, and now that that's that they've been called to account on that, there's now this expensive and damaging and rather like crazy making move to try and create incentives to bring more Black communities and businesses back into the central neighborhood.
So the second part to my question is that, you know, you kind of hear this in on two different levels, right? You know, JP, William, Hannah are talking about this in very human terms. In our previous event, someone actually typed in the chat, Plato Filipino is not a restaurant, it's a community service. So they're talking about this in very human terms. But when you go to planning and you have the plan, it's like 14 stories, 15 stories, you know, you're saying sorry, sorry store, they're saying 5163 Joy Street. Right? So when planning hears this, and Neil, you've been on the inside, I don't know if I'm asking you to disclose secrets, right? But like, what happens when planning departments hear this?
It's a good question. It's not an easy question. So I may stumble through it a little. Ultimately, our service is to the community, right? We work with communities, we work for communities, we work in collaboration with communities. And that's not an easy thing because communities themselves are intensely complex. And so you get a lot of different signals and a lot of different inputs. And we certainly in the Vancouver case and throughout Vancouver, one of the big pushes is, you know, we really need to act on and maximize affordability. Now we could debate whether this is a good model for it. I don't think it necessarily is, but that's one of the things that's kind of pushing behind it. You're also kind of always balancing between the very real need to respond to community. And at the same time, also trying to sort of live up to that fairness idea. But, well, we don't like to treat certain businesses differently. We need to be broader and look at broad pushes and dynamics and trends or whatever that support businesses generally or support different social gatherings, social ways of being and living in a community without being specific to any one community. Now that doesn't mean I think we need to always have maps that have 14 stories, 15 stories, 5136 or 5150 Joyce or what have you. I don't necessarily agree with that. But like, just to reveal a little bit of that thinking is there's always a need to almost adopt a degree of impartiality. I think it's a dangerous trend, but it's one that's really prevalent in the field.
Will, do you have anything to say about this? I think you have a very interesting kind of perspective because, you know, you were in planning school and now you're in this kind of situation.
Whenever we shorten it to TOD, I think transit-oriented development, but I also think transit-oriented displacement. And that's another way of hearing it and saying it. And I had a conversation to Andy Ann about it. We had a long sit down over coffee. When we think about these businesses and what they how they matter to the community, we see them as ways of getting jobs. Like you talk to someone over the counter, they say there's an availability next door. If you're looking for work, or if you're a permanent resident and you're looking for housing, there's something way over there across the city. When you're overhearing a conversation at Plato Filipino, you're hearing about a lady who just came back from work, who took 6 buses and 2 sky trains to get here because she needs to feed her son and kids. When you look across the streets, the redevelopment sign is and you see it kicked in, you see community members talking about it, chatting casually about their kids who are staying at the daycare at Collingwood Neighborhood House and how they're playing and getting along and how they should set up a play date, all speaking in Tagalog. These are informal community centers and we should be treating them as such. It's concerning. It's concerning that the city isn't doing enough to protect them. And this is because we have been kicking up a fuss about intangible cultural assets since before I was born. Like the city has known about the role that food plays in immigrant households for a long time, and there's research around it. I just wonder why now that we're only getting those cultural asset protections, and now that it's being researched, and that's my two cents about it. That's my loony.
So Hannah, I wanted to ask you, like, because Will mentioned transit-oriented displacement, and so your work with the neighborhood house, are you kind of like, I don't know if forecasting is the right word, are you kind of anticipating what impacts this will have in the work that you need to do with sort of expected changes in the neighborhood?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And, you know, in thinking about my work, these changes are already happening, right? And that's evident in the number of Filipino elderly seniors that come to my office, you know, seeking assistance to apply for co-op housing, subsidized housing, rental subsidies. And many of these seniors, you know, this goes back to what JP was saying about placemaking and the histories of placemaking, in that many of these seniors settled in this neighborhood decades ago. They came as migrant workers. They came as live-in caregivers, right? And, you know, I thought about the kinds of the entrepreneurship in, there's this cluster of Filipino businesses in Joyce Collingwood. There's Plato, right? Pampanga's Cuisine, the Sari Sari store. And I want to highlight the Sari Sari store because they have an in-house remittance service, right? That is available for Filipinos who send money back home. The culture of remittances is a huge thing with Filipinos, right? That it counts for 10% of the Philippine GDP. people are not only working for themselves here, but they also are helping to lift their families out of poverty back home. And, you know, going back to the history of migrant work and migrant activism in this neighborhood, right? Many of the seniors who have settled here for decades have stayed here precisely because it's been affordable, precisely because they have had access to these cultural assets, because of the access to these, you know, kinship relations, right? These kinship relations that have afforded them belonging and that have afforded them community, right? Many migrant workers are exposed to exploitation, discrimination, and racism in their workplaces. And, you know, the last thing that they want to come home to is, you know, to feel further marginalized in their own communities, right? So these like places like Plato Filipino and St. Mary's Church, where a lot of migrant caregivers actually partake in, you know, religious fellowship there, provided these, like William said, these spaces for belonging and these spaces for community. And, you know, but now with the rising cost of rent and the lack of support for seniors that are culturally sensitive, it puts a lot more pressure on service providers like me as a settlement worker to provide advocacy for them. And applying for subsidized housing is often a very, very complex process, right? It requires so much verification. It requires so much documentation. And a lot of the times, you know, I'm working with elderly seniors who are not very well versed with technology, who are forgetful, right? And who oftentimes do not have all of these documents that I'm asking for. And so that puts a lot more pressure on service providers like me to provide letters of support, right? Letters of verification that explain and advocate the applicant's need for alternative housing in urgent timing. And so these are very complex cases that take up lots of time. And it's not that we don't want to do it, right? We will help anybody who needs support, but increased reliance on our services definitely puts a lot more pressure on us to deliver, you know, more robust advocacy. And settlement work is highly racialized work and therefore highly unseen work. And although I take this responsibility very seriously, it can get very overwhelming for a lot of us settlement workers. And it you know, these circumstances really risk burning us out and ultimately pushes a lot of community, can push community workers away from the work.
Can I add to the comments Hannah had about affordability? Okay, thanks. So Hannah's right. These spaces were affordable at some point, but the community has started to move out because of rising unaffordability. If transit-oriented development was supposed to increase density in this neighborhood, it's doing the opposite effect of pushing them out. And they've had to commute long distances in order to access the same affordable services and amenities that they had traditionally used. So services like St. Mary's Parish or the affordable cultural foods at Pampangas and Plato, that's no longer a 15-minute walk away. And it's doing the opposite effect where they may even have to drive to these locations. We don't have any idea of how far they're really driving or traveling in order to access these services. That's a research gap that we don't have. And that's all I wanted to add.
I'm going to follow up, but JP, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, a couple of things come to mind for me. And they've been anticipated by Hannah in her comments around, you know, marginalized communities not being able to participate in urban, like very formalized, highly bureaucratic, highly technical kinds of forms of citizenship that are often expected of folks who, as a result of effects of policy, are just wanting to get by and survive or needing to be calibrated to that level of being. So that is another, I suppose, gap is around civic participation and its accessibility and legibility to people. And, you know, that the barriers to Filipinx civic participation is something that I think needs to be talked about, not as a failure of the community, but as an effect of larger systems of inaccessibility and also marginalization. Because I think partly, you know, what Neil mentioned earlier around, you know, fairness and as a principle of planning, treating everyone the same, you know, we also need to think about that in relation to that principle not actually living up to the fact that we don't live in a level playing field to begin with. I think Meg already also mentioned that in her comments earlier, right, around, you know, there's already the game has already been set for us, and so we're not starting from scratch, and that is partly, I think, a civic participation issue and how its accessibility is shaped by, you know, all manners of social networks.
Can I just say one thing, Bill, in response to JP, which is that not only, so there, I agree that there is this element of engagement that's missing and engagement is in fact seen as a problem as opposed to a route to a solution within the formal planning processes now, but also this project that I referred to briefly that some of my students and others engaged in the South Vancouver neighborhoods just in the past year and a half in Sunset, Killarney, and Victoria Fraser View, what we found was that In spite of this, you know, this claim to wanting to treat all neighborhoods equally. In fact, when you look, when you ask the city of Vancouver for how they are spending social dollars, how they're spending on communities for some of, for things like food, food supports or community grants, social infrastructure grants. Certainly when it comes to the spending of CAC, of community amenity and development contribution levies in communities, there are profound inequities in the neighborhoods. And the city's not going to tell you that. You have to piece it together, which we tried to do in order to find out just what that landscape looks like. And it's that also is a root of the perpetuation of these profound inequities. That, you know, there's this sense that you have to. Even for neighborhoods that are growing. So South Vancouver neighborhoods are growing in population, but they're not pouring enough concrete, really, when it comes down to it, for in order to sort of merit the investment dollars into social amenities, community amenities, and the kind of things that help to that fuel the pump of community work within existing neighborhoods.
I want to pick up on that blank slate comment that Meg made and JP referred to. And I'm just going to repeat myself and say that, like, when you read the neighborhood precinct plan, it talks about creating social interaction. It talks about creating something. It doesn't talk about what's already there. And, but in terms of planning, right? When you go to planning school, when you learn about cities, we know that there are other ways to plan. Like none of this is new. Like how we ought to be doing it, none of that is new. Why isn't it happening?
I can try and then pass it on. Yeah, so I did want to say that, you know, the city of Vancouver, it worked for its reputation as a city of neighborhoods. That was a catchphrase of the city plan process in the mid 1990s. And that was a reputation that it earned since neighborhood-based movements in the 1970s, right? The militant Mothers of Raymer in the downtown Strathcona neighborhoods. So it was a group of moms whose children had to cross the train tracks in order to get to school. And they organized and they stood on the train tracks and they stared down a train in order to ensure safe crossing for their children to get to school. And that in turn was a movement that led to the formation of the Ray Camp Cooperative Community Center. So there is this proud tradition, and there are others, you know, there are other examples that I'm sure other people can cite too. But there has been this loss of the notion of neighborhoods as being an asset, as being one of the things that Vancouver's success, to the extent that it's been successful, is built upon, towards this prevailing sense in documents now and in public hearings and listening to the discourse around City Hall, that neighborhoods actually are the problem. It's neighborhoods that are preventing the city from being able to meet its grand plans and strategies. And I think that's really, to me, that's really wrongheaded and really problematic. That's the planner's conceit, right? That's when planners who spend too much time in City Hall away from the life patterns and what's important to diverse members of diverse communities in a big and growing and changing city, they sit back and they think that they can build this sort of master plan that really becomes increasingly divorced from the reality of what's possible and what's coming as the city changes. And they increasingly see themselves as just in opposition and fighting against these, you know, unreasonable neighborhoods that are stuck in their ways without understanding what's valuable about where the city is and where it's going.
I absolutely agree with Meg. I'll add a new one. So not just grand plans, but this idea of the grand bargain that Gord Price always talks about in Vancouver, that not that you're in opposition to the neighborhoods, but almost a reaction to neighborhoods as being something to protect. And therefore, where can we shift the new development where they're less impactful? Now, there's all sorts of problems with that, right? One part is, how do you determine what an impact is? And we're starting to understand the full complexity of the impacts of some of these decisions. But there's been a growing trend within cities everywhere. I don't want to just pick on Vancouver, but Vancouver, absolutely within this, of where can we push our higher densities where we don't upset the most amount of people. Right, or at least the most amount of people who are traditionally used to hearing from in loud voices, the West Side neighborhood, right? We don't go into Kitsilano because, oh my gosh, are we going to get yelled at? We don't go into to Grandview Woodlands, or we go in gingerly because, oh my gosh, we're going to get yelled at. And absolutely not fair. We have not gotten yelled at nearly enough in East Van and particularly in South Van. And we've started to see that pop up more and more and more. And so it's not so much an anti-neighborhood, but not really a full appreciation of the complexities of neighborhoods as social ecosystems and just really wonderful, interesting places. And how can you support and allow them to evolve and thrive as needs continually change? Because every community's needs absolutely do change. And I think I worry that it's not, you know, Bill, you're right. Like, you're taught in planning. I like to think we teach in planning school differently. I was taught in planning school differently, but there's so many, and I don't want to defend this. I really hope this doesn't come across as defending it. All these tensions to plan faster, right? Move plans through faster, right? You're taking too long. You took 3-4 years on Mount Pleasant. And when, for example, the Joyce Precinct plan was launched, the ambition was to always move through a plan in about a year and a half. And there's some good reasons for that, but there's dangers when you're not really spending the time to understand place, the full complexity of place. So there's that tension. And not to only pick on the city, but to pick on the broader structures, there is so much downloading in the city. So the city's always now looking to do almost more and more and more through development. And that pouring concrete phrase I thought was really apt, right? Because we rely so much on new development to provide the new amenity, including housing, not just market housing, but below market and supportive housing through the CAC system, right? As projects come in, we rezone them, the land value goes up, the city's able to secure a big chunk of that and invest that back into the community and go through the planning process to identify the priorities in that community and so forth and so on. We're really relying on that. And that's by no means an even playing field. What the CAC are able to secure in a rezoning in Alberni Street in downtown Vancouver is many levels greater than what a rezoning will do. And not that you ever rezone for this, but it is part of the calculus that gets achieved in East Fantasy. So we shouldn't be so reliant on the system, but we are. A lot of it's because, if anything, I think the city is scared. It's scared to have this sort of harsh, frank, honest conversations. And it's looking to sort of an acupuncture-esque way to avoid the controversy, which, of course, as we all know, anytime you try to avoid a controversy, you just set a bigger one afire. Those are a few thoughts.
There's a lot of questions that I want to ask based on what everyone's saying, but we have limited time and I want to be able to move to the Q&A. So I want to ask a last question to everyone. And it's not really a question, it's more, I'm going to make a comment and I would like you to react to it. So one of the issues raised with this proposed development is the displacement of a cultural asset, particularly one that is important to underrepresented communities. 6 years ago, when the development on Joyce, this is the one that's at the northeast corner. This is the West Bank building, the Hive condo tower. When that went in 6 years ago at public hearing, there was a comment made about three or four businesses being displaced. And it was a very kind of like flat response from planning. When I think like some of the people like Claire and Jillian, when they did their slice of support campaign, they asked planning about the displacement of cultural food assets. And very quickly, this kind of surprised me, like very quickly on the Shape Your City site, they put up all this language about cultural redress, intangible cultural heritage, which would have not happened 5-6 years ago. Right? So I guess, what do you think about when you hear, is this happening because there's a larger social mood around, larger social movement around equity?
I'll jump in.
JP, you want to take that?
There's a lot of push. Part of it is, and anyone who spent any time in the city staff knows, they are actively trying to learn. They go through a lot of work themselves. Everyone has a lot to learn. They have a lot to learn. We are seeing a generational shift, changeover. That's helping. But boy, howdy, is the pressure, the advocacy of community groups like Slice Mango, absolutely is making a huge difference, and I'm really grateful for it.
I think there's something temporally specific about this moment, and it has to do with the kinds of, the activism that precedes, the foundation has been laid partly by the activism that has been going on in the last 5-6 years. I think the COVID-19 moment and attention to anti-Asian racism and also community organizing, of which I had been lucky and honored to be a part of, around ensuring that responses to COVID-19 don't forget the fact that long-term care homes and hospitals and a lot of our food services, labor and labor spaces were places that are that have been labeled essential during the pandemic, are staffed by a lot of people in our community. And so that the activism around that, ensuring that response to COVID-19 is culturally appropriate and specific and attendant to the reality that COVID doesn't affect everyone equally. I think that's part of the groundswell in the community, I think that energy also energized. And there's overlaps, of course, with Tulayan, for example, between that activism and the activism that is happening around Trump's Collingwood. So I think that is also partly it. I also want to recognize a couple of observations that I've seen in the neighborhood. One is there seems to me to be a really active, perhaps newer generation of folks in the neighborhood house who are like actively organizing community, ensuring that their work is culturally appropriate and culturally responsive. Some of that is routed through food justice and food activism. And I think that making that connection between that work and the importance of the cultural asset is really important. And then the amazing savvy mobilization of social media, for example, of like Slice Mango Collective. I think there is something important there around kind of short circuiting, if you will, civic participation. Because a lot of that activism was routed not through community networks, that a lot of which is informal, as opposed to just the kind of formal ways that we participate in urban planning processes. So I think that is also important to recognize here, that savvy, that activism. It's an important and I think underappreciated form of civic citizenship.
Thank you. I had a follow-up, but maybe I'll try to sneak that in later if I have a chance. I'd like to give, there's a couple of people who are were quite important in the Slice of Support campaign. We're here with us tonight. And Jillian's here. Jillian works for Collingwood Food Justice at the Collingwood Neighborhood House. Jillian, you have a question. Would you mind unmuting yourself and asking your question?
Hey, yeah, Jillian here, Food Justice Coordinator at Collingwood Neighborhood House. I have a question for Will. Will, you were talking a little bit about the community town hall, and I know that you're in the process of digesting all the stuff that you heard. Would you be able to elaborate a little bit more about the messages and key takeaways that you had have digested so far from this neighborhood discussion and kind of those implications that you see from that discussion for the future of Vancouver? Transit-oriented development and cultural assets as a whole.
Thanks, Jillian. I'm going to connect that question with some of JP's last comments about the situation around equity. There is an appetite for finally dealing with equity in our city, and that was evident from our town hall. Equity around affordability was something we heard a lot. Finding a place to live, not being able to stay in the city. And then there was discussion around as food assets disappear, communities harder to find. These are mirror from what we're hearing as an aggregate from the city overall. Where are we going to go if we're going to get displaced? The city is becoming unaffordable. How are we going to afford food? That is a direct echo from this aggregate data. But what we're hearing is how it's affecting our community specifically. And how that plays out is the stories we heard from Tita Bennett, from Sliced Mango, about their own personal connection to these food assets and businesses. Stories about how when they were a child, they, you know, access these foods, and where they're going to go to access other culturally appropriate foods. These are the same things, only it's specific to our community. And so where are we going around cultural assets? There are a lot of policies that I think the city should be applying to help protect our community. And they're policies I think should be applied to yesterday. The first one is right of first refusal for protection of ethnic businesses. As if they are offered a place to stay, despite, you know, the development still happening, as long as they're offered that space, our community has a guarantee that we can still come back, even if they have to go for a little bit period of time while that development is being put into place. Right now, we're building these massive condo towers in the idea that it's going to be occupied by a Starbucks. Like that's not going to help our community. First right of refusal, that's the first policy. The second one is around easing the design of buildings. So Hannah had mentioned earlier sari-sari stores also having remittances. Remittance offices can't actually be put within a sari-sari store unless it's in an enclosed space. That's the design guidelines for a grocer. So we've had to get around it by registering our remittance offices at the individual business owner's home, but still operating out of the sari-sari store. This is a design gap that could be updated with a new update of the design policy of the city that need to be explored with this review of intangible cultural assets review. And I think that's where we're heading towards with cultural assets management in the city. I'm hoping that we can have an open discussion with the city about it. I believe they have our best interests in mind, and their developments are pushing through. And as they keep getting pushed through, like it's just like it's expediting the need for that to sit down at the table with us and look at these policy proposals. And that's my loony.
Thank you, Jillian and Will. Claire from Slice Mango is here. Claire, could you unmute yourself? And I realized that I used Slice of Support campaign several times, but I didn't explain it. Would you mind explaining it and then also ask your question? Thanks so much.
I don't mind explaining that. Thank you, Bill. Also, thank you to all the panelists. I've am very happy to be here to listen to all of you speak and give your loony, as Will has said multiple times. I'm one of the co-founders of Slice Mango Collective, and Slice of Support was one of our first campaigns. It happened in March of 2021, and it was a reactionary campaign. It was a reaction to basically the Joyce Collingwood Food Hub, of like Filipino food hub businesses being up for redevelopment. One member of our team had noticed that through, I think it was run through Collingwood Food Justice, that these businesses were up for redevelopment, and she had sent it to the rest of the team, and she was like, hey, is anyone doing anything about this? Does anyone know what's going on? And all of us were like, well, we don't know what's going on, and we are part of this community. I grew up in East Van in Joyce Collingwood, so I was very surprised. And once we started kind of reaching out to like our parents, our networks, we'd realized no one else was really aware that this was happening. And we just kind of, with a lot of community support, kind of put together Slice of Support to bring awareness that, you know, these food hubs were kind of under threat. I hope that makes sense. I hope that's a good a good snapshot of what we were doing for the month of March 2021. And I guess I will launch to my question then, if there's no further comments or questions about Slice of Support. My question is actually going to be directed at Hannah, JP, and Will, because I think it just concerns the Filipinx community as a whole. Because we've been having these conversations about Joyce Collingwood specifically and the food hub in Joyce Collingwood, but I'm wondering if you guys can talk a little bit about what these discussions really reveal about the needs of the Filipinx community in Metro Vancouver. And what does our community response to what's happening say about, I guess, our community and how we've been trying to make a place for ourselves here?
I can talk my way through an answer. It's a big question, Claire, but I think it's a really important one. I do think that what we've heard from the panel tonight, including through Hannah and her really grounded work in the community as a settlement worker, is that the needs of our communities and the particular kinds of pressures that our experience at Joyce Collingwood in relation to the food hub are connected to like much larger and structural issues around what it means to be Filipino in the Canadian context. We've invoked issues related to immigration policies, particularly the ways that temporary worker programs, caregiver programs, routes are, and I mentioned the non-recognition of foreign credentials. These are structural issues that that jurisdictionally are not the city's issues, but they have particular conversations because they are lived intimately at the level of the street and homes and the ways that we navigate our lives in specific context. So the ways that what in my research I'm calling abandonment, a racial abandonment takes place through the confluence of these multi-scalar processes, right? That include immigration policy that then kind of trickles down to schools. We talked about educational incompletion that also manifests in terms of the ways that immigrants are treated or not treated as citizens whose participation in decision-making processes are properly either sought out or even impossible. And that's a large answer to your large question, Claire, but I think a part of what I'm trying to do is also to spotlight the issues that we have been discussing around Joyce Collingwood are actually manifestations of, again, larger issues that shape what it means to be like Filipinx in the Canadian context. Hannah, Will?
Go ahead. I saw them out. You go ahead. Okay, I'll go. So what does it mean for the Filipino community? So there are 24 organizations, societies that operate within Vancouver that deal with Filipino identity. And they all pretty much galvanized around this issue, which is honestly so surprising to have every single organization be attuned to what's happening in an issue in our city. To me, I'm echoing JP about the need for public participation, especially for newcomers and immigrants. I don't think I've ever seen my grandmother or like first generation immigrants engage with anything related to the city, unless it was about permanent residency or adjusting a traffic ticket. Like those are the limited ways that I have seen the Filipino community engage with the city. That's a huge gap. Like we should be engaging with the city about telling them why we don't want a sign up in front of our house, or asking them to support an event that we're throwing on the street because we want a temporary place to be partying. Like there are so many avenues for our community to be engaging with the city, and traffic tickets and permanent residency are the few meaningful ways that we've been engaging. I'm not surprised that those nonprofit organizations like Slice Mango, those organizations like Slice Mango are having to be the default instead of a public hearing, having to offer those translation services instead of the city doing it by themselves. It's a testament to like the Bayanihan spirit, where we're all in this together and we're all in the same boat rowing towards like a shared future. But I'm sad it's on the backs of volunteer labor, unpaid volunteer labor. And that's my loony.
I just wanted to add something there if we have some time here. So just kind of springboarding off of William and JP's points about, and in my attempt to answer Claire's very good question, you know, in trying to, what do these stories reveal about the needs of the Filipino community? It's a great question because it, you know, really invites us to think about the politics of representation, right? Filipinos, despite being the fourth largest growing visible minority in Canada, are still largely invisibilized when it comes to discussions about, you know, local politics, accessible city planning, and civic participation. And I think, like, you know, one of the root causes of these, you know, going back to these distinct challenges that Filipino face and as a result of transnational migration you know, issues like de-skilling, like low wages, hazardous employment, and punitive immigration law. These are all meant to exhaust, extract, and disempower migrants from taking action. We are physically exhausted, right? I work with migrants who work multiple jobs and who are doing so much, and that we don't often think about, you know, the detrimental effects of these larger infrastructures, these legal, political, larger infrastructures that are physically exhausting, extracting so much from our communities. And what I'm trying to say is that sometimes, like a lot of times, our people are on survival mode and they can't think about anything else but to you know, get food on the table, to pay for rent, to pay for their niece's education in the Philippines. Like it's just these little, like it's a lot of these things that I think when you're not, you know, part of that community, or if you don't share that experience, it gets really difficult to understand why there is, you know, this, what we see as lack of civic participation among Filipinos. And I just want to say that, you know, we are perfectly aware and capable of intellectualizing our experiences. We know what is happening to us, right? But again, we're just so exhausted and tired that, you know, and it's because these systems are meant to exhaust us. They're meant to tire us out so that we just can't even think about fighting back and fighting for ourselves. And so I leave with more questions and answers, but it really invites us to think about, you know, talking about even like the impacts on Filipino health, right? I think there is a large gap in the literature and in the research and in the discussions talking about mental health, right? How these distinct issues that plague our communities, how it's affecting our health and how it's also affecting our movements and our participation in local governance. And so I think I encourage or invite everybody here to, you know, think about these questions and think about, you know, the ways that we are not able to participate in these in local politics, and the kinds of structural impacts and the structural processes that, you know, affect our ability to advocate for planning projects that engage with the community.
Thank you so much for your answers and for spending that effort and energy to communicate these matters. There's some questions in the Q&A and some comments in the chat, so I'd like to turn to them. The first one, do you think that transit-oriented development as it is for the Joyce Collingwood neighborhood now, which is challenging to the community, might in the long term have any benefits? So I guess that depends on benefits for who, but anyone want to take a stab at that?
I'd like to hear Will's answer to that question, because just the way that you you laid down a couple of very specific solutions that you'd like to see, which suggests to me that you do think that there's something to go forward towards with those changes that you recommended.
So I think transit-oriented development is actually a really great idea. The idea that we can get people to and fro within a short amount of time with less use of resources is something that the Philippine community needs, especially in a time of climate crisis. We are the third most at-risk country for sea level rise. We have the most pollution, plastics pollution of our seas, or one of the most. And it's just so needed to have Vancouver use less resources, especially while the world's burning. I think it would have long-term benefits for like the Philippine community at large. In terms of this community at Joyce Collingwood right now, as long as they're able to take advantage of the opportunities that housing and amenities affords them, transit-oriented development could be a good sign for them, could be a good policy for them. But there's an absence of policies that would keep them in place to take advantage of those amenities. Things like first right of refusal, things like the design of a business that would allow them to put more in there that would suit the more needs for the Filipino community, like remittances, like a green grocer, like good ethnic food that feeds the soul and heart. There are other policies that I would like to see as well, including like equity zoning within the Joyce Precinct Plan. We talked about the need of seniors who are leaving the area, seniors who have lived there maybe since they first arrived and lived there because this space was affordable. My grandfather was one of them. He came in the 70s. He worked on the railroad when it was still at Yale Town. And he had to leave the area. Now he's in Mission because he had health conditions that wasn't supported by amenities in the area. There are policies that need to be implemented to keep the community safe and healthy, and they're just not put in there. And there's so many other policies that are needed to make transit-oriented development in Joyce a reality and good for the community. And that's my loony.
Anyone else, or shall I move on? Okay. So this is from Jenny. What would it take to mandate neighborhood engagement processes that start and are co-designed with deeply rooted, long-serving community members?
I have one thing for this, and it's just to point out something that I don't think a single member of Vancouver City Council lives south of 16th Avenue. I would defy anybody. Neil, maybe you can, have there been city council members from the Joyce Collingwood neighborhood? Have there been city council members who are willing to sort of stand up for a particular neighborhood or for an ethnic or an immigrant community? We don't have that culture built into the city. We could, there are cities that do that. It would change the way that decision making happens, and it would change the risk reward ratio of participation and engagement in city processes drastically.
Kerry Jang was in Renfrew, but Meg's point is solid. My concern is with the word mandate, and it's less about how do we require it, it's how do we inculcate, how do we develop a way of working that's meaningful, enjoyable, engaging, and welcoming to a broader community that isn't designed to continue the pattern that we've been going down, and where we're happy. We get numbers in Vancouver that we generally consider to be pretty good. Right? We'll get like 200 people to meeting. That's dramatic, but that's still a very small slice of the actual neighborhood. And it's not necessary. Well, I absolutely agree. And it's actually a pretty good tradition of co-design and co-planning. But as it moves through the process, something gets lost. So it has to be a different way of working not necessarily a requirement or a new form of checklist would be my addition. And whether it's a ward system or not, I don't, wards have other complications and challenges. I won't get it. I'm just not getting into that. Thank you.
If I could quickly add, I'm not too sure about the ward system. I have no context whatsoever, but the city tried something really interesting for their fan plan 2050, where they had city navigators who were part of community organizations, be interlocutors for getting feedback and city direction on policy. And I thought that was pretty great. I think where it could have been improved was having these city navigators possibly at the beginning of the engagement rather than at the end of the when they engage the broader population. Because at the point of where they engaged city navigators was close to the tail end when they already had all the aggregate data. But I think what could have been improved was getting the aggregate data through surveys and at focus groups, but at the same time, having the city navigators do their own engagements and do focus groups in specific languages, do broader engagement across like all of Metro Vancouver for people who live, work, and play in Vancouver. Like there are ways to improve how we're engaging with equity-seeking communities. And I think we're heading there, but it remains to be seen.
One thing that I'll just spotlight, which is really something that's already been said, is the need for proactive opportunities rather than reactive ones. I feel like at least the example of the community activism in Joyce Caldwell, and the way that it's panned out in the last year or so has been to react to something that we didn't know about as a community, and then organizing from there. So kind of energizing grassroots activism and kind of community formation, I think, is an important foundational kind of work that needs to be supported and that needs to happen so that we can identify needs before we need to react to specific issues that our communities face. What I mentioned earlier, I'm not saying that's absent. I think there's already been quite a lot of community activism and organizing that's been happening. Some of them have been directed towards, certain issues over others. And so widening also the, from within our communities, the ambit of what we consider to be issues of importance to our communities is also part of that work. And, that ties back to the question of what would it take what is the wording that Jenny used? So what would it take to mandate neighborhood engagement processes? I think it has to do with energizing civil society groups, energizing immigrant or racialized communities, empowerment at the kind of ground level for us, by us. Kind of approach. So whether I'm not certain that can be mandated into a municipal planning system, but there are also other ways to support it. And our communities have been doing this work off the side of our desks for a while. So, and I think that also needs to be recognized. The kind of kernels of that are already there.
Thank you. There's a lot of questions now, and I'm trying to find one that we've not kind of touched on yet. I think this question kind of speaks towards the future and what can be done. And so this is, how can we as individuals advocate for these neighborhoods when we witness all this direct and indirect displacement and loss of sense of place? So like, what do we take away from this talk tonight? What can, for people who care about this, what can we do?
Can I say one thing about that? One thing that I notice, and I'm hearing some of this amazing work in terms of organizing around the Filipino community and community-based organizations serving immigrant Filipinx members. But what I'm one thing that I haven't heard too much about, which I think also ought to be on the table, is the sort of supply side of this argument too, which is to make a case to the city about how much the city, in its interest and in its expressed interest to serve equity and to serve its community in terms of resilience and other social goods, needs immigrant communities in order to have any hope of meeting the demands and the health needs, the economic needs of just having a functional city at all. I think that, you know, in addition to, you know, to making demands for engagement and asserting rights, I think that there is a case to be made to the city around how much work is done that otherwise the city would be incapable of doing without all of this, without all of this social network, all of this community-based resourcing, that it's really shooting itself in the foot by not paying attention to that and by trying to put these physical planning structures in place that have the effect of making it impossible for that important work to continue.
JP, do you have any advice?
I want to go back to something that I started with, and I think this ties to what Meg is saying, is around how we narrate the place of immigrants and people of color in the city. I mentioned earlier that we need to think about ourselves, by which I mean Filipinx communities, as key placemakers, as shapers of this city. And I also mentioned earlier that some of the things that make Joyce Collingwood really inviting, including to real estate developers, the sense of vibrancy, the sense of place, the amazing, you know, food and other kinds of businesses that are there, that was built by people who are at risk of being displaced, right? And so that kind of that recognition of the important ground building city making work, right, I think is a narration of our history that I think is necessary for not just the Filipinx community to reckon with, but also the city more broadly, that multiculturalism is not just an asset that sells condos or that attracts tourists. It is the like literal building block, it's the people that make up, you know, the streets, the kind of lifeblood of this city. And, you know, the Filipinx community is just one. There are also many others. And so I suppose, and there's a question in the chat that I'll just gesture to. I don't think I can answer it. Asking us to make linkages, for example, to Chinatown. I think cross-immigrant, cross-racial solidarities are also really quite important. The learning from each other in terms of, you know, what has worked, what assets or what resources might be in place, what knowledges can be shared, right? What routes to activism are more effective than others. These are the kinds of conversations that I think could be done horizontally across racialized communities also. And I'm really grateful, particularly in the last couple of years, to have been able to work with Chinese and Vietnamese speaking community organizers on the C19 Response Coalition, partly because there was a lot of specific work to our specific communities, but also the sharing of rich knowledges, right, in terms of strategy, in terms of resources. So that's another kind of point that I want to make in relation to the future, is that we have never been doing this work alone. It would require that we also cultivate and sustain our ongoing relationships with other communities also.
So before I thank everyone and we say goodnight, I want to make a quick comment about Chinatown, since JP has mentioned it and there was a comment about it in the chat. I think given what we're talking about, when we've been talking about having a more people-centered, human-centered way of planning, Chinatown is very important. Even if you care zero about Chinatown, you should care if you care about human-centered planning, because that's one of the few places where that's being attempted in the city. That's one of the few places in the city where it's looking at perhaps where culture, so ways of living, is being, that's a basis of how they're planning it. So it's not just land use planners there, but there's also social planning happening there, and arts and culture is involved there. So it's quite different from other areas. And they had a hard time kind of finalizing their sort of getting their strategic framework passed a few weeks ago. But I think the work there, if it can proceed, can be helpful to a lot of neighborhoods across the city, because that's one of the places where they're actually talking about, I think someone mentioned Seattle, and land trust, removing land off market, right? Things like that. And they're starting to look at measures of, we didn't get to talk about this tonight, but what you might do to bring back or keep a business that's important, like Sari Sari store in the neighborhood when there's development. So things like that, I think it's really important to kind of follow Chinatown and support Chinatown, even if you care zero about Chinatown. Well, I think we're pushing towards 9, and we're pushing towards 10 for Neo. I'd like to thank everybody for attending this. I hope this has been an interesting conversation for everyone. I really want to thank Hannah, Meg, Will, JP, Neo, Jillian, and Claire. But I also really want to thank Olivia and ISA. They're with Asian Canadian Asian Migration, and they've been helping us with tech. This talk is recorded, and we will make it available at some point soon. Perhaps we will do something with it and send it along to City Council, or because Christine Boyle, Councillor Christine Boyle, she was the one that put forth a motion on food, protecting cultural food assets. So it might be important for them to see this. Maybe we'll send it along to planning and see if they care to respond. So with that, I'd really like to thank everyone again, and have a good night.
Thanks very much, everyone. Thanks very much, Bill. It was great.
Thank you.
Great chatting with you all.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks all.
Salamat, thank you.
Does anyone want to debrief after this conversation?
Sure, I can debrief.
We're still recording, well, yeah, just so.
Do you want me to turn off recording?
Yeah. We've lost Meg, though, but yeah.